Welcome to the Hair Boss Not Hair Loss podcast. Today I'm joined by Celia Samada, the Facility Academic Support Lead for the School of Business at University of Sunderland. But Celia's journey goes beyond her professional achievements. Whilst living in Saudi Arabia, Celia was diagnosed with cancer. Determined to receive the best care possible, she made the courageous decision to return to the UK with her two lovely boys, leaving her husband to continue working abroad. And during multiple surgeries and setbacks in her reconstruction journey, what set Celia apart is her unwavering positivity. Throughout it all, she remained a pillar of strength for herself and her children. Today, we delve into her story of overcoming adversity, finding hope and life after cancer. Hello, Celia. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I know that you're a very busy lady, and I'm just so over the moon that you're my guest this morning. I feel like it's going to be a very easy podcast because we are friends.
Yes,
so I wanted to start with, couldn't you just tell the listeners a bit about you, who you are and how we know each other?
I am, first and foremost, I'm a mother of two teenage boys. I'm a wife of a wonderful husband. I've got a cat and a dog. I work for Sunderland Uni. I'm in the business school. So I'm an academic support lead, which basically means I just look after the students. So I look after their retention, make sure they're happy and that they're achieving the highest grades they can possibly achieve. I'm also a life coach, specialising in health, weight loss, well-being. And I've done a combination of that for the last 18 years, alongside a full-time professional career as well. How we know each other is I was living and working in Saudi Arabia and I was diagnosed with breast cancer.
Tell us the story and the journey from your early career to your diagnosis. Yeah, tell us that story, please.
So living in Saudi Arabia with my family, we had a wonderful, wonderful life. I was running a health and well-being and fitness business on an evening and a weekend on the compounds in embassies, doing motivational speaking around health, well-being and fitness. Then during the day, I had a day job. I was an advisor in the Saudi government. And then I was diagnosed with breast cancer, which was extremely inconvenient. I was like, how am I going to fit this into my life? I literally just landed my dream job in the Saudi government as an advisor. I was unofficially coaching the senior women in leadership. I was coaching senior leaders who were women in life coaching, business coaching, whatever they needed. I tried for 3 months to get treatment in Saudi, and it was just, although the services there are amazing, I had a wonderful oncologist, nothing beats the NHS and being at home and being able to just have that conversation with somebody in your own language and they understand what you're saying. So I made the decision, well, my husband and I had to make the decision for me to come back to the UK for treatment and leave the family over in Saudi. So for the first 6 weeks, the two boys, because we didn't want to disrupt them, they were in Saudi with my husband. My husband was going to leave work and come back. And I was like, we can't just stop the whole life. This is just an inconvenience. It'll pass. It's only a year. It's a year out of our lives. We'll get through it. It's fine. We'll just work with it. So that was, you know, a difficult decision. Came back here. And then after 6 weeks, we agreed that it was better that the boys were with me because I needed that extra support. You know, being by yourself here, by yourself, as in you haven't got your immediate family around you. And I had to go through chemotherapy, which is when I met yourself, Nicola, because I lost all my hair. I did have a wig, but it was dreadful. I felt like a footballer's wife. It was so over the top, glamorous and in your face, which totally wasn't me. And then a few people had recommended yourself to me because the wonderful wig business was, I think it was relatively new at that stage, but I was in the early days. And I came to see you to see if you could sort out this horrible dry footballer's wife wig. And then we just hit it off from there. Kindred spirits, very like-minded. Yeah. And you sorted out my first proper real hair wig, which is actually just like my own hair. So that was how we met. And I've been friends ever since.
Oh, we have, which is the best part of this story. So So if we can just go back a little bit there, would you mind sharing with listeners your exact diagnosis? What kind of cancer was it? Because that wasn't particularly an easy diagnosis, was it, to get?
No, it wasn't. So it was breast cancer. And when I was in Saudi, the initial diagnosis was that I had it was HER2 positive, and it was a 1 centimeter tumor. So the Saudi government were like, we'll pay for you to go back to England and have, you know, go private. That was part of my kind of health insurance I had with the job. So I came back here for a lumpectomy. I'd booked a week off, came back to the UK, went to the Spire. And within 10 minutes of seeing the doctor there, or the surgeon, he wanted me to have some more tests because some of the scan, the mammogram I'd had in Saudi wasn't clear enough. And then after an hour, I discovered it wasn't just a centimetre, it was literally the full right breast that was affected. And after some more histology tests, I had two types of cancer. So I had HER2 positive and ER positive.
Yeah.
And I was told I needed a mastectomy. So that was a bit of a shock because inconveniently, I'd planned a week out of work, and then I was flying back to Saudi, and it totally changed the whole direction of what needed to happen.
Yeah, it changed the course of your treatment. It also obviously changed how your body would look, because we're talking about going from removing a lump to removing your full breast. So that must have been a terrible shock.
It was, but you know, when I went, so I had my mother and my mother-in-law in the room with me, and they're both wonderful, but both very different characters. My mother's very stoic, very, yep, that's fine, just get it chopped off, was actually what she said. It's fine, have a look at you. I'd love to get my breasts removed. You know, like these kind of people say things that are not meaning to be tactless. They're just like, yep, this is the way it is. And then my mother-in-law, again, so lovely, but she just cried constantly. She was so upset because it was devastating. So actually for me, although it was a shock, as with everything, I'm just like, okay, let's just process this. How do we deal with this? And it's more thinking about how I respond is going to impact how other people feel.
Yeah.
So actually it was a shock, but I just thought, okay, let's get on with it. It's not what I want to happen, but we've just got to get on with it.
Well, you mentioned there that actually you decided after a few weeks that the children would be with you. And this is something that I think so many people within diagnosis are worried about their children. It's completely natural to worry about your children.
Yeah.
But there is such strength in just getting a cuddle from your kid. You don't need to be talking about the cancer with them, but actually the fact that they were with you and just in your house is enough for them to bring you comfort without them even knowing anything, isn't it? Yeah.
It totally is. And it's also, you know, I've suddenly gone from having this manic, hectic, busy life where you're looking after a house, you're looking after your children, your husband, your pets, your job, to being almost like a single person, living by yourself, doing what you want, no routine, no structure. So actually having the boys, it gave me that kind of purpose every day. You have to get up. You can't just lie in bed because you've got to get the kids to school. But it is, and that, you know, never underestimating the value of getting that just affection and love from someone else with you definitely helped a lot.
I think another thing, I used to always make reference to, no matter how hard this is for me, I can't imagine how hard it is for Steve, because the only thing worse than going through it yourself would be watching the person who's your world go through that. And to touch on the fact that Adam, your husband, how difficult it must have been for him in a different country. You know, not only is his wife going through that, but he can't give you a cuddle at the end of the day. How do you think?
That was devastating. I think still to this day, we're nearly 6 years on, and that's still has an impact on him, because he was helpless, and he'd be sitting at work and he's like, what's the purpose? Why am I here? Why am I sitting here earning money, not being able to support my family, when actually he's, in his mind, his primary role is to support his wife and his kids. And so it was awful for him. And it's that I never, ever saw it as a big deal. For me, death was never an option, never has been. It was just like, oh God, again, inconvenient, a bit like being pregnant. That's how I looked. I was like, right, I've got a year. Okay. Pregnant, you get fat, you have heartburn, piles, feel sick, all of this, can't sleep. Then you've got a baby, you're still fat, you've still got piles, you still, you know, all of this. But then you can't sleep because you've got a baby. But I thought, well, okay, just look at it like this. This is a year. You're not very well. You need some treatment. You'll be fine. So for me, it was always like that. But I know for Adam, it was instantly. And I think a lot of partners who go through this, for them, death's the first thing. He was actually planning my funeral. I didn't know this till afterwards. I'm like, why? Like, I'm just a little, just got like an illness. That's all. It's nothing to be particularly stressed or worried about. So it is a lot worse for Adam. It was a lot worse. And it's that feeling of helplessness.
Yeah. I think. And yet, I think something to touch on there would be that actually, you know, you can't all just up sticks, stop going to work, stop earning a living. You've got bills, you've got commitments. I know for me, being self-employed, one of the biggest things I was like, well, how can I not go to work? I've got the wages to pay. I've got my mortgage to pay. I can't just stop going to work. And just like you leaving that job, and it wasn't an option, was it? So it's just how you navigate that.
It wasn't. But what I do need to say that is that I love Saudi. I still do love Saudi people. They supported me. They actually kept me employed. And I went back after treatment to finish off the job that I'd been employed to do. And they were so supportive throughout the whole thing. Yeah. They were wonderful.
So tell me a little bit more about how having cancer and a diagnosis of cancer changed your life.
I think it reinforced to me that I was kind of on the wrong direction. So I've always had two career paths. So I've got the professional career on the business side, you know, where I've been in a senior leader for like 25 years, managing massive teams of people. And then the other side is like the health and well-being and fitness. And I was always unofficially life coaching people. I hadn't actually done it as a paid business. And coming back here, having treatment, it just made me think. I remember because I was in the hospital every single day. For the summer, I'd had the treatment because we had lots of complications. And I used to see the same nurses and doctors and surgeons. And I just thought, these people they're dedicating their lives to saving other people. And it made me question, like, yeah, I'm really good at what I do, but actually, how's that making an impact on the world? What's that doing for people? And so it was that made me think that I need to do more. I'm on the wrong direction, as in I'm not doing enough to help other people who maybe go through the same thing. So that was kind of the driver behind making the life coaching an actual business. And what better time to do it than when you're sitting in chemo for 6 to 10 hours, which is really boring, and you can't move from the chair. What better time than to set your business up? So I built a website during chemo. I trained as a cancer counsellor, because it's a luxury having time like that. And that's the way I viewed it. Suddenly you've got 6 hours of doing nothing. So I was like, right, what am I going to do with this time? Let's make real use of this time so I can actually start to then make a difference. So that's kind of one of the big things where it's changed positively. Negatively, definitely body image. I've always been very confident in the way that I look. I always liked the way I looked. I always liked my breasts. Never had any problem with them. I had two very nice breasts. And, you know, I remember one of the surgeons saying, you know, you're lucky you've got the breasts of like a 22-year-old. Bear in mind, I was 41. I was like, I know, I've never had any complaints about that. And then suddenly to have no breast, that for me was horrific. That and the hair loss were the two like really bad things from a body image perspective. Because it does, everything does change. Your hair does grow back, but for me, still the worst part of the whole cancer journey and the treatments is losing your hair. From a body image perspective, it does change. You know, your shape changes, your weight changes. Obviously, when you've had surgeries, I'm like a patchwork quilt now. I've had so many surgeries. I've got so much scarring, and it never looks, your body never looks the way it originally did.
So when you had your mastectomy, you opted to have reconstruction on the same day, is that right?
Yeah. Against the advice of the doctors.
So please.
Reasons I understand now.
Yeah, but when speaking to you, I really don't think you give yourself credit for how incredible your attitude was throughout cancer. Most people do not sit in chemo writing business plans. Most people do not think of it as I've suddenly got 6 hours today. Most people are in bed, rolling around the floor, crying, thinking the worst. You are exceptional in your mindset. And I think, you know, I'm sure I'm right in crediting that to the work that you've done on yourself, and being a life coach has given you those skills that actually you were able to process horrendous news a lot better than a lot of women could. But when you said there, the biggest things were around your confidence and your body and having that reconstruction against the advice of the doctors, tell me why you did that and what that meant to you.
So the whole thing for me from the beginning, it was an inconvenience, wasn't ever anything major. I know it is major. I don't want to make it sound as if I don't think cancer is a big thing. However, I didn't make it a big thing, because once you accept it's a big thing, then it becomes a big thing in your mind. It's all about your mindset from my point of view. So for me, because I'd had chemo first and I'd had I'd had Herceptin, which is a really strong type of cancer treatment, and it knocks your immune system, so it's really, really low. So I'd said to the surgeon, I want a major reconstruction because I just want to be not I want to be back to normal as quick as possible. From a body image perspective, I didn't want to just have one breast. I didn't want to have one breast, even though eventually it would be rebuilt. I just thought, well, why if you've got the option to have two breasts, would you not go for that? And because the doctor's advice was, it's up to you, you know, the patient's choice, but your immune system will be low. We can't guarantee that your body's going to accept an implant. And I was just, no, it was no question. And I wouldn't go back and change it, even though I have extreme amounts of surgery as a result of that decision I made, but I would still go back and try it because I just wanted it to be normal. I wanted it to get out of the way and get back to normal as quick as possible.
Yeah. So elaborate a little bit more on what went wrong, please.
So I had a major reconstruction with an implant, and my body basically rejected the implant. So it kept on building up fluid. A couple of days after the surgery, I had one of the drains removed. And as the drain was being removed, a nerve had been hit and it set off a chain reaction of 12 hours of extreme pain, and I ended up collapsing, passing out and being rushed into hospital. And then I got cellulitis. The fluid was still building up because my body was rejecting the implant. Then the skin started to split. So I had four surgeries within 8 weeks for under general anaesthetic. Every 2 weeks, the surgeon would take me back in. It kept splitting. He would stitch it. He would put a smaller implant in. He'd remove the implant. You know, he tried everything and it just kept on rejecting it. And in fact, I had it was a surgery, but I went to the clinic. I was due to have radiotherapy, and there's a window of time for it to be effective, as I understand it. And when I went back in to see him after the fourth surgery and the skin had split again, bear in mind I had no implant in at this point, but I just had a hole in the skin, he said, I'm going to have to bring you back in again and sort this out. And I was like, you can't, I have to start radiotherapy, just stitch it now. I was like, just do it now while I'm in the clinic. And he said, I can't give you any anaesthetic. I was like, I don't care, it doesn't matter, I've got no feeling in there anyway, just stitch it, just get it done. I can't put this back any longer. So I remember he was like, okay. So did like a surgery in the clinic for me, stitched it up again. Yeah, so that was kind of five surgeries really.
I can't, by this time we were friends, and I remember just thinking,
I was sick
just,
of it at that point.
Yeah. You were also frightened of general anaesthetic. That was your biggest fear,
wasn't it?
Not now.
I know.
That summer got you over your fear of general anaesthetic. It wasn't like the outcome. You were just frightened of going to sleep, weren't you? And you had to do that over and over.
Yeah, the feeling of it. And yeah. I always had that fear that you'd be awake during your surgery and nobody, you couldn't tell anyone. Totally irrational fear, but yeah, soon got used to it.
So for a lady who just said that the body image was your biggest thing, how did that affect your confidence? Like ending up 5 surgeries later, multiple complications and disappointments, and then effectively ending up with something that looked a lot worse.
It was awful because it was two years before I got the first reconstruction surgery. So you're flat chested basically on one side, which when you've got clothes on, you can, you know, it's about changing your whole style. I had to change everything that I wore because you're flat chested, and you totally underestimate how many, even if you don't wear things at a low cut, just having one breast totally changes, you know, how things look. And of course, I was, you know, living in the Middle East and you're sunbathing all the time. So I had to wear just really what I felt were unattractive swimwear that I was always conscious about, because you're conscious, like I didn't want anyone to know that I only had one breast. So it makes you really, vain's not even the word, just self-conscious, like constantly checking and not being able to dress the way you'd normally dress. So yeah, it was awful, which is why I would always still try for an immediate reconstruction.
So you would not change that, Celia, going back?
No.
You would still have done it the same way?
Yeah, because you had to try it. It might have worked.
That's interesting.
It might have worked.
That's really interesting. So can we talk a little bit about the kids? Just touch base on, as a mum, other listeners who are facing this kind of thing and with children, how old were your children and what did you decide to tell them and how did you tell them?
So the boys at the time were 9 and 13. Now for me, I'm a very honest person, very open, always have been with the boys. I think that there's levels of what you tell your children, but I still think that if there's something massive like this, then, you know, my husband and I discussed when was the right time to tell them. We waited until we got all of the diagnosis that I was aware of, because I was getting treatment in Saudi at that point. But because of the situation where I'd have to fly back here for surgery, we would have to tell them anyway. And I didn't want to lie to them, because I thought if they found out something later that we've lied about it. So it was difficult to decide when to tell them. Telling them was never in question. But I never made a big deal of it. We sat them down and I do remember telling them, and, you know, Otis was 13 at the time, but he's always been very, very mature and very, you know, he knows what's going on. And he said, I knew as soon as you started to tell me what you were going to say. Theo was younger at the time, but we just managed it the best we could. And you tell them what you feel is the right thing to tell them. I didn't make a deal of it, because to me it wasn't a big deal. It really wasn't. It was like, okay, so I'm not very well, but it's the word cancer that I think really is this, they've got the biggest stigma around it, because cancer can mean anything. Cancer can be something that actually is no big deal, or cancer can be something that's an absolutely massive deal. So it's this whole spectrum. So for me, it was telling the boys, listen, I'm just unwell. I need the treatment, which will make me sick, but I'm going to be fine. It's not a big deal. It's not, you know, we'll make it as minimal impact as possible. And I remember a couple of years kind of after treatment, Otis had said to me, he said, you know what, Mum? He said, you never made a big fuss about it. He said, you always just got on with it. He went, so I didn't really think it was a big deal. Like, they knew it was important, but he was like, it just didn't affect me in a negative way because you never made it a big deal. You just got on with it.
Wow.
So for me, that was like, thank God, that's, you know, I think maybe for Theo, because he was younger at the time, but they were fine. Kids are resilient. Kids are actually resilient. And actually, I think it's better if you're honest with them to levels. You know, they haven't known the extreme levels. They don't know what I look like. It's not necessary as far as I'm concerned. They just need to know that I've had treatment. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But actually, everything's fine.
You should be proud then, if that's what you said.
I'm happy with that, because that was what I wanted, was that they didn't feel it was a big deal.
Yeah, that's really, really, really good advice, I think. The word itself is just so scary, isn't it? And it can mean so many different things. So I think you handled it brilliantly.
It wasn't easy, but yeah.
No. Tell me now about how your experiences have changed what you do. So in terms of the retraining and things like that.
So when I was going through chemo, set the life coaching, built the website, did the business plan, trained as a cancer counsellor, which I would offer to people for free. I still actually, I wouldn't say I counsel people. I'm there as kind of a support. And the way it changes for me from two perspectives. So one, from a professional perspective, I think when you're managing people or you're working with people, it just gives you a different level of empathy because you understand when somebody comes to you with something that similar that they're going through, it gives you that different understanding, that empathy. From the life coaching side of things and the counselling side of things, again, level of empathy helped me to understand. But I actually support women now who are going through cancer, and it'll be often it's friends of friends who are referred to me. And I do this, I don't charge for this. This is just, I've got a lady in Saudi at the minute who I've never met before, but a very close friend of mine contacted me and said, I don't know how to help her. I don't know how to support her. You've been through it. Can you talk to her? So I've just been talking to her on WhatsApp. We've never physically met each other or face to face or on Teams, just on WhatsApp. And I think that, and you'll understand this from going through it yourself, you know what to say to people. You're not afraid to say the shit stuff that happens, and you know how people's minds are. Whereas when someone hasn't been through it, no fault of their own, they don't know how to talk about it. They're scared to say stuff. And actually, we're just the same person. Just talk to us. It's, you know, we're not bothered. Actually, people welcome you being open and honest with them. So it's changed me in that I have a deeper level of empathy and understanding for people. But I feel I can help more people and be there if somebody needs me to talk to them. Just not even give advice, just say that, yeah, I know what you're going through, but you know what, you're gonna be all right, you'll be fine.
I think it's just an immediate relief when somebody says, yeah, I hear you, I get you, I understand. That's all you have to say. And I think personally the worst thing you can do when you meet somebody who has been diagnosed is not to mention it. No, it's like, I this know. That's for me is much worse. I don't mind people saying the wrong thing. I didn't mind people saying the wrong thing, but if they don't acknowledge that actually you're going through something huge, then that hurt a little bit more than anybody ever saying the wrong thing. At least they've acknowledged that you're going through that.
I know one of my close friends, she avoided me for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
This was in Saudi. And I went, I had to be the bigger person and go around, knock on her door and say, why are you ignoring me? And she was like, I'm so sorry. I just don't know what to say. And so all I did was I went up and I gave her a big hug and I said, right. I said, I've rubbed my cancerous breast on you now. So it's not contagious. Stop giving me the sympathy face. I'm still me. Just forget it. It doesn't matter. Like, it's not an issue. So I know what it is. It's other people's kind of, they don't know what to say for fear of upsetting you.
Yeah. What advice would you share for people who may be facing cancer without their partner here, or they might be a single woman, or yeah, just people without that support right next to them? How did you find support when your husband wasn't here? Where did you go for your support?
So I had some amazing friends. I mean, I'm lucky enough that I've got a supportive family. I had both my mom and my mother-in-law, very, very supportive. But I had, and this, with as with any massive thing in your life, you find out who your friends are. And there was a very small number of friends who literally just, you know, they were amazing. Obviously, I met yourself. You are one of those amazing people for the level of support that you gave me. But it's just this, you do need a support network. And whatever that looks like, it might be support groups. For me, that was never a thing. I'll give you my views on that in a minute if you want. Obviously, family. I had some amazing friends who would literally, when I was by myself, one of my friends, she would ring me at the beginning of the week. She'd write, right, get your diary out. This is what we're doing this week. And pulled me into their family basically to look after me. And likewise, people in Saudi did that for Adam, which I thought was really lovely. They were like, right, we're going to look after you because you need someone as well. So having that support, you need a support network, because otherwise you just would end up being by yourself and it would be easy to get into a negative, woe is me, why me mindset if you haven't got people around you who are like, right, kicking your ass out. Come on, you're coming out.
Yeah. So please do elaborate on your views around support groups.
Yeah. So for me, and again, it's all about this mindset. I'm not a negative person. I don't mourn. I don't complain. Never once when I was going through cancer did I say, why me? Because if I was saying, why me, that means I'm wishing it was on someone else. And that's not nice, because you wouldn't want to wish it on someone else. Don't get me wrong. I wouldn't want to do it again. I wouldn't want to go back through it again. But actually, I did do it, and you get on with it. You just deal with whatever's thrown at you. But support groups, I did join a few support groups on Facebook, and it was just, I find that a lot of forums like this, not just for cancer, like with any kind of group, a support group, it's very easy to slip into this negative, mourning, complaining mindset. As an example, I have to take tamoxifen for 10 years because of the ER positive cancer, and there's a tamoxifen group I joined, and literally anything, and you know this, Nicola, any single little ailment or problem or anything at all, you could stub your toe, it's tamoxifen's fault.
Your cat dies, it was tamoxifen's fault.
And
yeah,
for God's sake. And I just think that some of these support groups actually fuel this negative, woe is me, let's complain, let's mourn attitude, and that irritates the life out of me. Because, and social media does this, you know, it's very easy to get pulled in a downward spiral. And actually, just remove yourself from any negativity, because if no one else is giving you this negativity, then it's very hard for it to kind of build up. So for me, support groups like that, and as well, and I know this is quite controversial, but like, I'm not bothered. I'll tell anyone, I would tell anyone at the time that I had cancer, but actually, I didn't want people to know that I had cancer, because people will then view you differently. That was why I chose to wear a wig. I wanted to be as normal as possible. I wasn't bothered about telling people I had cancer, but I wanted that to be my choice. And so I just think if you get kind of sucked into all these different channels, it's just reminding you of the fact, actually, you're seriously ill. You're seriously ill. So for me, it was like, I just wanted to be normal.
Yeah, I get it. I do get it. I think that you can find whatever you're looking for online. And if you want to stay in the depths of darkness, then there are groups like that, many of them. But there are some good ones. There are some good ones as well online, where it is a message of hope and positivity. And it's just finding where you fit in, isn't it? What would you say to somebody who has just been diagnosed celiac, somebody who is just being given that bombshell?
You have to get all the information. Don't be in denial. Like, you have to get as much information as possible. For me, and I think for a lot of women that I coach and a lot of women I speak to who go through cancer, it's this: you've got to take back some control. Because when you have cancer, you're trusting your life to the doctors and nurses and consultants and surgeons who are looking after you. But you're actually passing your body over to the illness. You've got no choice. And so it's this loss of control. And I think that's a big thing for most women, is that they feel this loss of control and power over themselves. So get all the information so you've got an action plan. It's much better. For me, the most stressful, worrying time was waiting for the results. Because once you've got the results, you know what's happening. Fair enough, it might be worst case scenario, but you work out, right, what's the action plan? What can I do? And then that's taking back some kind of control, and it's giving you a focus, and it's looking at little steps. So we know the end goal is, you know, we want to be fit and healthy and well. But actually, there's a long way to get there, so it's little steps. Which, you know, Nicola, I'm not very good at these little steps. I'm a bit impatient. So I would definitely say, be informed. Don't shy away from finding out everything. You need to understand it all. Understand what your action plan is. and take back the control that you can take back. So for me, the only control over my body when I was going through chemotherapy and surgeries was to make sure that I ate well and I exercised. That is literally the only control you've got. I could have wallowed and sat and watched TV and ate loads of biscuits and put loads of weight on, but no, which is, again, comparative to pregnancy. It's what people tend to do. I'm pregnant, I can eat what I want. Other people are like, I'm going through chemo, I deserve a packet of biscuits. But for me, it was a case of, well, you don't want to end up worse than what you started with. So get your control back, do your exercise, keep eating healthy. And that gives me you a little bit of power and control over your body.
Thank you. Thank you. Can you tell our listeners where they can connect with you and find out a bit more about what you do outside of your professional career?
Yes. So I've got a website. It's called The Blue Zone. So it's theblue-zone.com. Just to clarify, it is not called The Blue Zone because people feel blue with sadness. It's based on the Blue Zones theory, where there's certain places in the world where people live a longer life, and it explores certain elements of their lives that they have in common. So I'm all about helping people with your mind, your body, your soul, your spirit. It's kind of a 360 wellness. So it's looking at finding your own blue zone to make you have a longer life, a longer, happier life, because you've sorted out your mind, your body and soul.
Perfect. So thank you for being our guest this morning. I've really enjoyed talking to you, as I always do. Thank you for being a great support to me as well over the years. I really value our friendship.
Oh, likewise. Thank you so much. And thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to my Hair Boss, Not Hair Loss podcast. I really hope you've enjoyed the conversation and found advice, positivity and some inspiration. Head to the show notes for more information and follow the podcast to keep up to date with future episodes.